Hello and welcome to the Spooktator podcast. I'm your host, Hayley Stevens, and I'm really pleased to let you know that the Spooktator recently joined the Stimulus Network, a network for podcasts covering topics from science fiction right through to actual science news. You should visit www.stimulus.network to discover our podcasting partners.
This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
As the first issue of a new true crime magazine hits the shelves in the UK, here at the Spooktator, we couldn't help but wonder what exactly it is that makes societies around the world so obsessed with true crime in the first place. With this question in mind, welcome to the Spooktator Goes True Crime. That way in which horror movies can have the most horrifying things to them, but you just can't resist going to see more of the same, even though it's just, it grosses you out or horrifies you, scares you silly. That's thought to be caused by something called annihilation anxieties, and it turns out these anxieties can present in a number of different ways, and pathologically they can become serious conditions if not dealt with appropriately. But they essentially involve a danger which poses a threat to your survival, which could be experienced as a menace or a monster or a situation, or as anticipation of something that's going to happen that's going to be catastrophic and cause problems for you and threats to your survival. And I was reading up on this and I found this article in which sociologist Robert Wanzer says that these anxieties can essentially draw us to horror films, and in particular zombie films, to help us deal with our fear of these threats to our mortality. But also that they help us to come with to terms with political unrest and the mistrust that we might have with governmental bodies. And in his research, Wanzer writes, and I quote, "In zombie films, outbreaks are usually the fault of government and institutions who act both as a source of the outbreak but also as the gatekeepers for any cures. And given the context of a zombie pandemic, the pessimism towards government is not unexpected. Their families are dead, they're disconnected from any sense of social community, and they have few promising prospects for survival. Their nihilism is symbolic of the lack of public trust that exists for public institutions, a growing theme in contemporary zombie cinema." So also the piece that I found quoted this guy called Dr. John Mayer, who told Forbes magazine that he and other practitioners are seeing an influx in patients who have genuine fears of the apocalypse. And this is all mainly thanks to the 2016 US election. And John Mayer is quoted in this piece. I almost said John Major then. That's a different person. Dr. John Mayer is quoted in this piece saying, "Prior to Trump's election, it was a garden variety of anxieties. I can't pay my mortgage. I'm going to lose my job. But with the advent of Trump, people are saying this guy could put us on the brink of nuclear war. Now, a lot of us practitioners are seeing an influx of people who are worried about the apocalypse." But Mayer says that he isn't surprised, noting that an interest in the apocalypse and zombies in particular has always been a cultural response to major political turmoil. So all of this got me thinking about the role that the media might play in these anxieties. Because obviously nowadays we have rolling news coverage 24/7, which in my mind makes the world seem like a much scarier place than it probably is. And I certainly think this rolling news coverage is the reason that a lot of my older relatives post those things on Facebook where they're like, "In my day, you could go out at night and stay out till the lights came on, blah, blah, blah. Kids these days," when actually it's the same. You can still do those things. It's just, it seems like the world's a worse place. So people have these anxieties about you mustn't let the kids go out and play on their own and so on.
Yeah, we're more aware now of, you know, stories of kids being taken, accidents happening and things like that, because we have this sort of interconnected global news now. So threats like that, like something happening to your kids, seems much more real nowadays, which is why people because you're confronted with things much more often than you would have done in the past. So it's not really any surprise that perhaps parents don't give kids the same kind of freedom that they used to in the past, a lot of the time anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, those crimes did exist back then, you just didn't hear about them. Which is, I think, is actually even scarier in a way.
Yeah.
But then this got me thinking, what if the same constant news coverage of every detail of every scandal and crime is also the cause for the obsession that so many people seem to have with true crime? Because anecdotally, and the reason that we decided to actually have this discussion podcast episode is because it seems that in the last few years, true crime documentaries, podcasts, websites, etc. have popped up everywhere. And although correlation obviously doesn't always imply causation, I wonder if there's some sort of link between the way in which crime and public unrest is reported and our need as citizens to consume true crime and horror movies.
Yeah, I think it's not just so much that there is so much true crime stuff out there that you can access really, really easy. It's almost like these things, like the first series of Serial, like Making a Murderer, they become sort of like the cultural thing which everybody is talking about. It becomes like the significant thing that everybody is tweeting about. It. Everyone has theories and things like that. That it yeah. goes beyond it just being kind of the regular entertainment and actually becomes like, this is like a cultural signifier of our times, that we seem to be going really hard for true crime for whatever reason at the moment. I mean, just this week on to standard television, you will find any number of true crime documentary, either one-offs or series. Netflix is inundating us with them. And of course, that's countless numbers of podcasts which deal with true crime, which are enormously popular at the moment. So it is everywhere, and it's very, very easy to get swept up in it.
Do you think it really has grown, though? Do you think it's people are more into it now than before, or do you think it's just that they talk about it more?
I think there is probably, it's being able to admit that this is the kind of thing which you find interesting seems yeah. to have become something which people can talk about much more regularly. They're able to say, oh yeah, I actually do watch documentaries about serial killers for whatever reason. And it feels like that discussion, people used to kind of keep that to themselves because there was always true crime programming to some extent. There's always been things on TV, especially. There would be whole channels dedicated to just true crime. And now it feels like people are just feel more confident for whatever reason to be able to say, yeah, this is something which really fascinates me too.
So do you think there's a correlation there between it becoming more socially okay or acceptable to say, I watch true crime documentaries, I've got books at home about serial killers, in kind of the same way as it seems to have become more acceptable to say that you're interested in the paranormal? Because it definitely seems as though, I mean, back in the day, you know, previous generations of ghost researchers would not have had so many people openly coming to them with, you know, claims that they've got a haunted house, and yeah. ghost tourism was never a thing before.
So I wouldn't be surprised if there was a big crossover with the people who are watching true crime things and who have also have an interest in the paranormal, especially ghosts, who perhaps were the audience for Most Haunted. I know it could be like a sweeping generalization saying that, but there are people, and I'm certainly one of them, people who do just have a taste for the morbid sometimes, and true crime and the paranormal, they can kind of go hand in hand sometimes.
I think we look at podcasts in the same way we look at iTunes. Now, when iTunes came in, there's like a lot of quote unquote crap music entering the charts quite high because there was an amonicity. Is that the right word? Yes.
Yeah.
To buying an awful song that you didn't have to go and purchase physically in a record shop.
Yeah, you didn't have to face a cashier.
Yeah. So now you can just go, oh, I'll get the Bob the Builder song on download. No one's ever going to know, and it will only cost me 99p. The podcasts are the same, I think, where people go, oh, well, no one knows I'm going to listen to this seedy subject, which is quite dark, and everyone thinks I'm quite nice at the office, but actually I like serial killers. And so you get
I can be sitting on the bus on the commute to work listening to the most horrendous things and nobody will be any the wiser.
Now, what I think that brings, though, when a popular podcast grows, like My Favourite Murder, is I kind of think it breeds a slightly kind of, this is a bit of extreme, but hopefully it makes sense, like cult think. Because when they all come to the theatre, they all know they're there as a unit to celebrate the fact that they love murder. Yeah. And it's quite weird when you hear them whooping when their town gets a name check, when eight women were raped and murdered in a famous forest next to them. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I just think podcasting and this, and true crime in particular, has just grown out of the fact that we think we're living in time without order. And I think when you look at programmes that either tell you the outcome to how they caught a serial killer, which gives you some reassurance it can be done and they can be caught, that's one thing, because it leaves a certain bit of order in your brain. But also the mystery ones, the ones that you don't know about, is just like being showered with information that you're keen about.
Yeah.
So you take it all in, you go, oh, even if it's not true, what a fascinating story. So you kind of get the best of both worlds from it.
I think the My Favourite Murder thing, just going back to what you said there, I used to listen to that podcast a lot because I used to find it quite interesting, but it did seem to take a turn when they started to do the live episodes.
Yeah.
It became a little bit weird and a little bit too...
There is something quite strange about people getting quite so excitable for murder. And I know that there is like a degree that it's like a cultural release that because like having an interest in things like this, there is still a taboo about it. Being in a group of people who are able to say, actually, we all share this kind of morbid interest, we can actually just let ourselves go a bit.
But I think there's a different kind of catharsis, though, because I think between the difference between horror films and true crime programming, with horror films, there's a sense of you don't need to worry about it because you know everything's fictionalized and it's a ride, and it's an experience, whether it's a grueling one or a fun one. Whereas with true crime, there seems to be like a bit of scab picking to human nature. And you know you can't do it in real life, but it lets you scratch that dark side of you to some extent.
Yeah, I agree.
Everybody has that side where they actually find that, I say everybody, many, many people have this side where they do actually, you want to revel in the dark sometimes. And I enjoy horror films. Yeah. I like being scared. I like ghost kind of stuff. And it running through, I've gone through all of my books to some extent, they are about death, whether it's about Jack the Ripper or whether it's a funeral director solving mysteries. There is this sort of like morbidity just slightly underneath the surface. And I think it's because we all do find death fascinating to some extent.
I think people I think they find death fascinating, but maybe for a lot of people, I think it's actually quite terrifying.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And, you know, there is, I mean, having met a lot of people who think they've got ghosts, one of the things that I've kind of learned from the process of doing that is that pretty much everybody that I've met has been afraid of their own mortality in one way or another and looking for some sort of a confirmation that there's something more, either they're looking for it for themselves or because somebody they love has died. And I think when it comes down to the crunch of life and death, I think everybody has that kind of anxiety about dying, even those of us who are just, you know, like I'm an atheist who I don't believe in any afterlife and I just think this is the only life we've got, but that's enough for me in a way. So it's like optimistic nihilism. but even I still get kind of anxious about dying, especially I've had a lot of deaths in my family recently. As we're recording, I've just arrived home from a wake. It's like literally, I think like in the last 3 years, I've been to 6 or 7 funerals of very close relatives, and it gets to the point where actually you do start to think, what about when I die? It's just very sudden.
It's like lying in bed at 2 in the morning when your brain is suddenly just working through, it's like that kind of existential kind of stuff which stalks you at that time of night.
Yeah.
I've got some tips for you. If you have those thoughts at night, here's what I did. I started creating board games in my mind and coming up with the play, the rules, what the board looks like, how you get points and what the winning objective. You'd be surprised how much that tires your brain out. And I go to sleep like that.
But the thing with going back to my favourite murder, like, what a weird tangent to go off on. But I read one study when I was kind of researching for this episode, when I knew we were going to be talking about true crime and why people are obsessed with it. I found this one study from 2010 that found that women were more drawn than men to true crime books, especially if those books contained tips on how to defend against an attacker, that women were likely to be more interested in books that contained information about a killer's motives than men were, and they were more likely to select books that had female victims. And to quote the research, our findings that women were drawn to stories that contained fitness-relevant information makes sense in light of research that shows that women fear becoming the victim of a crime more so than do men. The researchers conclude the characteristics that make these books appealing to women are all highly relevant in terms of preventing or surviving a crime. And the lead author of the study, Amanda Vickery, told the Huffington Post that, and I quote, "By learning about murders, who is more likely to be murdered, how do these crimes happen, who the victims are, etc., people are also learning about ways to prevent becoming a victim themselves." And I think that was quite interesting when you consider the fact that men are four times more likely than women to be victims of homicide, but women make up 70% of intimate partner homicide victims.
But you know what's weird about that statistic, and this is only going by some of the shows I've listened to, but most of the crimes are just random. You know what I mean? Like, there are very few process serial killers that stalker pick out. So it feels like I wouldn't learn anything. I mean, I know it's different from my perspective as a man, but I still would listen to those podcasts and go, well, I could be in my house right now and someone would jump out at me because he's been under the couch all night.
Oh, and I didn't learn that. Why would you fucking say that?
What are the odds of that happening to any of us tonight? Absolutely infinitesimal.
I'm now just like looking around my room trying to work out where someone could be hidden.
I find it fascinating that it's apparently true crime across the board, like every single, whether you're looking at serial killers, whether it's like spousal murders, it seems to appeal to women more, and round about that 70% statistic, except for organised crime, you know, when it comes to mafia and things like that. That is the only area in which men make up the majority of the audience, apparently.
I am just Googling, sorry, 2 seconds.
What are you Googling 2 seconds for?
You know, with the thing you were saying about someone hiding in the house, that's a real thing that happened.
Oh, it was also the name of a film. With Carol Kane in.
Oh, it's very, yes, good.
That's
When the Stranger Calls.
There we go. That ends with the infamous, he's calling from inside the house.
Yes, have you checked the children?
Yeah. If anything, all those films taught me was to never do a babysitting job, which I think is fair.
Just that thing about people being hidden just reminds me of, I don't know if you guys have watched Mindhunter on Netflix.
I saw some of I've heard very good things about it, but it just wasn't working for me for some reason.
Really? Well, it just, what you were saying reminded me of Richard Speck, and just horrible, horrible, horrible. He's the guy who killed...
Oh, it was the nurses, wasn't it?
The eight nurses in their home. Just, I mean, the idea of being trapped in your home with someone.
This is one of the things we actually were going to talk about, but how you can name a serial killer and... I will probably be able to tell you something about, you know, what they were known for. They do become celebrities, and it's not good that it happens, but there's no doubting.
You just know out there somewhere there is a serial killer top Trump set.
Oh, there must be.
Yeah, there must be.
In fact, I'm pretty sure that there actually is.
Richard Chase, Bloodlust, 99%.
Yes.
Oh.
No, there is no limits to people's appetite for poor taste.
I wonder if they've ever done a serial killer Cluedo, where you get to be all.
That would just be
Dharma.
So wrong. That would be so wrong.
Yeah.
It would be so wrong.
That's why I suggest.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that it won't have happened. So.
I thought you were going to say, I wonder if you know someone who's a serial killer. Because all of us. In our lives, we have no idea of knowing how close we came to being a serial killer's next victim.
Yeah.
And then they decided not to do it.
Yeah. Were you being, you know, checked out for, you know, that kind of, is this a potential victim? You'll never know.
Do you keep seeing the same brown Ford Escort
slowly driving behind you as you walk home?
Yeah.
See, the thing that made me think about this as well was my mum, a few years before she died, she told me this story about how when she was a child, they lived up north in Lancashire, and then the family moved down here to Wiltshire when she was about, I think, 7 or 8. And one day up in Lancashire, she went to the shops with her mum, and she decided to wait outside the shop whilst her mum went in and did the shopping. And she was like, she told me this man came up to her. I was like, hello, what's your name? And she was like, hi, my name's Sharon. He's like, oh, do you live around here? And she said, yeah. He's like, me too. And then he said to her, would you like to come with me and learn how to take an appendix out?
What?
And that's, I was like,
strange. That is move. A really, I mean, that is a step beyond strangers with candy, isn't it?
Learn I was going to say puppies.
An appendix out.
And I was like, Mum, I think you were nearly the victim of a serial killer.
Yes.
And it has bugged me ever since, because they didn't report it at the time because she was really young and she didn't think anything of it, didn't tell her mum. And now I wonder to myself, at some point in maybe the next decade or the next 20 years, will it emerge that in Lancashire there was a serial killer who took people's appendixes
out? Yes.
The Lancashire slasher.
A Lancashire slasher.
I remember when I was a teenager growing up in Cornwall, there was it's a still unsolved murder of a woman who was just out walking her dogs in the middle of the day, stabbed. It was like a completely brutal, random attack. And this was such a rural area that everybody kind of knew everybody. And everyone who was in this town, it was all males, I think, aged 15 to like 50, gave DNA tests, and there was this really strange just atmosphere around everyone suspecting everybody. Everybody wanted to be able to account for where they were that day.
Even a bit like on Broadchurch.
Yeah, very much so. That everyone wanted everybody to know that I was here, I was at work, there were witnesses there, saw me. That became just a general topic of discussion. Even in our school, because the school was quite close by, it was kind of like, well, who wasn't in school that day? And yeah, it's a really quite a... It's a very, very strange experience to go through. I still think about it a lot now, because I think it's the 20-year anniversary this year, and it still remains completely unsolved.
I'm a serial killer.
Yeah, do you know, I really wouldn't be surprised.
I love it if that wasn't your actual confession.
I know, well, that would be really odd, wouldn't it? And well, you could have stopped me, but you didn't believe me.
Oh God, don't, Paul. But that also, that reminds me...
I only target young couples, all right? I want to make it equal, so they have to both face each other and make one watch the other one die. I thought it through. Anyway, what's the next topic?
Wow.
What?
I'm actually a little bit disturbed. it does remind me a bit of in It's Always Sunny, how Dennis is clearly a fucking serial killer.
Yes.
And none of his friends realise. And it makes you wonder, do I know a serial killer?
Well, that's interesting, actually, you bring that up, because you know the episode they do on that where they presume he's a serial killer, and the episode's filmed like Making a Murderer.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting about that is I never saw Making a Murderer, but when I watched that episode, I completely got what they were doing, you know, with the shooting. And so it just kind of says about the language of true crime as well, in that no matter where you go, there tends to be a narrative, and depending on what information you get, depends on how far they want to push that narrative in terms of gore or detail, or whether you go from the victim side or the perpetrator side, there's still a recognisable language to telling these stories. I think it almost stems out of shows like CSI in many respects, because you look at like the classic detective drama, say Poirot or Sherlock Holmes and Columbo, and the crimes are almost not important. It's the process. You watch the story in terms of the process of how it's resolved. So that's what we like.
Yeah, I mean, you look at like Agatha Christie in particular, her deaths are never usually all that wild. No. Or elaborate. It is about that kind of methodical solving of it. It's like as satisfying as putting a jigsaw together. It's like there is disorder and chaos, and I am making some sense out of it.
Yeah.
What's interesting, though, I think about when CSI came along, was that it was the first show where the murder and the detail was the story. So it was all about the forensics. It was all about the corpse and things like that. And I think...
Yeah, it was the process, more so than actually even who did it.
Yeah. And I think that bleeds into true crime, because that's all about the detail, all about the process of the murderer and the logic and the big question, why? Because I think ultimately that's what it all boils down to. You listen to the story and you go, why though?
Yeah.
Yeah, with serial killers especially, it's the big question is always why. Why did you need to do this, or why did you want to do this? And it's also the one that's hardest to answer, especially because when you do actually see interviews of serial killers, they are usually incredibly guarded about what they actually do, and you tend not to get much insight into them at all. I did watch some of the Netflix Ted Bundy series, which was released, I think, a couple of months ago.
He's hot, I believe. Hashtag.
Yeah, apparently so.
Do you know, that whole thing about him being hot really creeped me out more than... Well, no, not more than Ted Bundy did. But yeah, he's a dead man, so how creepy can he get?
Him more than anybody else is the celebrity. Yeah. He's like the serial killer hottie.
The poster child for serial killers.
People's reactions to it. It kind of crossed the line, though, in my opinion. People were being disgusting. There's this man, he has killed women.
Brutally yeah. killed them.
Yeah. Yeah, brutally killed them and children. Raped them and also desecrated some of their corpses. And people are going, oh, he's so gorgeous.
But it's not new.
And they've cast Zac Efron to play him in a film.
But the thing is, that was around during his trial, the women outside saying, I love you. And didn't he marry someone during his trial? So he knew exactly what he was doing with that image, and he was selling it completely. And so that's the other distressing thing, is when the mystery becomes tabloid, when it becomes, you need to know everything. All the gory details.
Ted Bundy, more than any of them, he still has this strange sort of cult-like thing. I suppose you could say Charles Manson, I suppose, but...
Well, David Koresh certainly still has a following.
Yeah.
People who kind of still worship him. He wasn't a serial killer as such, but he, I think, definitely could be classed as a mass killer in that all those people died as a result of him.
It's strange how they get turned into like rock and roll idols. Like when, remember the Boston bombings, and they had one of the kids on the front cover of Rolling Stone.
Yeah, that was very controversial at the time, wasn't it? Because he did look, when that picture of him, he did look like a rock star. You know, and that's why it was controversial, because he looked like a cool kid who could have been in a rock band.
But then maybe this goes back to the annihilation anxieties that we were talking about before, in the these people, they're not monsters. They don't look like monsters. They look like us, people that we know.
You could walk down... they're boring looking people most of the time, aren't they?
Yeah, that you could walk down the street, walk past them, and you would not know what they were doing or capable of. And maybe that's why people react in such an obsessive way to Ted Bundy and David Koresh and Charles Manson and the Boston bombers, because some of them could be considered good looking people. If they were famous for other reasons, people would definitely fancy them and so on. And maybe that's in a way it's a repulsion, but it's not. It's this weird kind
One of the really disturbing things that you can go into online are like Columbine fanatics who kind of see the boys who did the Columbine massacre as almost like folk heroes, kind of striking back against the system. And they have, I mean, there is all artwork that you can find of them. It's a really quite frightening, but also sad world that you can look into, where people who have been usually been bullied or victimized at school for whatever reason, look to them as kind of semi-heroic figures, because we still have this kind of narrative in our heads about Columbine that they were kind of bullied victims who fought back, but they actually know that that was far, far from the case.
Yeah, exactly. There are people who've been bullied who fight back, who manage not to shoot up a whole school.
Yeah, and for the most part, it seems that they were the biggest bullies as well. On top of that, that was like a weird media narrative that came in the days afterwards.
I do remember that when I went to college, when I was about 17, I had a trench coat.
Of course.
And I wore it once, and then I couldn't wear it again because people were like, "Oh, you're part of the trench coat mafia. You shoot everybody."
I think they had that back in my day, to be fair. I think it must be a generational thing. God, I sound like my dad now. I think what's interesting though about serial killers is that most of the time they get to control their image and they feed that to the press that whom you know mythalize it. What's the word I'm looking for? Mythicalize.
Yeah, mythologize.
That will do. Yeah. Thank you, Charlie.
And there are people like BTK. He invented that name himself. He gave it to the media.
Did he?
Yes, it was his.
Yeah. After a few other attempts, apparently, like the Screen Door Killer or something.
Yeah, he had. That was like a third or fourth attempt, wasn't it? And that was the one which stuck. And of course, the Zodiac, he was responsible for his own branding as well. He even had created his own logo.
That's trendy,
isn't
it?
Yeah.
It wasn't just the name. Yes.
I like the idea of, you know, branding.
Yes. Yeah, I'm going to actually give myself like the unofficial logo for my crimes. And I'll give myself a name. And the thing is that it worked.
It did.
The media did go with it and just say, okay, we'll follow his wishes and we will call him Zodiac. And we will.
Yeah.
What's interesting about all of this is like there's so many shows now on TV, radio, podcasts, all this stuff. It's like when you hear in the news like, oh, they've just discovered some new Beatles songs. I thought we knew everything about the Beatles. What else do I need to know? And it's like the same for serial killers.
What else is there to uncover?
Yeah, it's like when that Jack the Ripper Shaw thing came up again recently, I was like, I thought we discovered that this was bullshit. Why is this news again?
Yeah, and news has just reported that the Cottingley Fairies are going, pictures are going back up for sale. And it's like, they've just been up for sale.
It's like every couple of years, Dorothy's ruby slippers go back on auction again. Yeah. And it's like, oh, must we hear about this every single time that they go up? And yeah, it's Jack the Ripper. He emerges again every couple of years. There will be a new book or something come out claiming to be, you know, that finally has been solved.
What you were saying about serial killers who kind of invent their own branding, you also find as well, don't you, that when the media report on things, you normally find that people then are inspired by what they've seen. And there was a 2009 episode of the NPR podcast, which is called The Psychology Behind America's Crime Obsession. And in it, they interviewed this guy called Dr. Michael Mantell, who served as the chief psychologist for the San Diego Police Department for a decade. And he basically said in this that our fascination with crime is equal by our fear of crime. And the media understands if it bleeds, it leads. And probably 25 to 30% of most television news today deals with crime, particularly personal crime and murder. Violent predatory crimes against people go to the top of the list. So it also makes you wonder, doesn't it, the way in which the media report these things, does it influence maybe people out there like the Zodiac killer, I don't know, to then go, do you know, this is how I'm going to get attention.
There has been, for a long time, there's been criticism, especially in the American media, about how whenever there is a large scale gun massacre, which seems to happen every other week now, the way that the news reports it, and making the perpetrators the center of the story, seeing their face, hearing their names, making them into these figures who everybody can recognize, that's actually leading to more of them happening. That seems to be the prevailing opinion, that making them into celebrities is almost encouraging it.
Well, in the aftermath of the mosque shootings in Christchurch, I found it really inspiring that Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, promised that she would not say the name of the person who committed the shooting attack. And following that, many media outlets have decided to do the same and haven't named him when reporting.
Yeah, and there were some places that even blurred out his face, like for his court appearances and things like that.
Yeah.
I think it's a very positive step in the right direction.
And in response to this, from Jacinda Ardern, Brendan Cox, who was the husband of the assassinated British politician Joe Cox, tweeted, and I quote, "When Joe was killed, I vowed the same. I have often genuinely forgotten the person's name and my kids have never heard it. Notoriety is such an important driver for terrorists and we should all get better at denying them it," which I think is an incredible statement. And I wondered how a similar approach would actually shape true crime documentaries if they took that approach, which robbed the killers of their notoriety and their fame and instead focused on the victims.
Well, do you know what's a problem with that, though? The backdoor problem, really, is like you look at the Terry Venables and the Bulger case, and it's like they did a horrible thing, they changed their name, but the press wanted to know who that person, those people were. And regardless of the argument either side, it's like that was the route that was taken. And could you imagine that one day someone wants to know who did this mass shooting and they've kept their names? Like, well, the public has the right to know. Well, do they, you know?
Is it further going to endanger the public actually reporting it in, you know, to that extent? I think there is an argument that the news does need to report what is happening, but there are also sensible ways in which you can do it, which isn't actually encouraging further violence. To
we could rename them.
Just give them all, they'll just be like a standard name.
Yeah, Captain Slaphead. Yeah.
Well, in the case of Jamie Bulger's killers, I mean, they were juveniles, weren't they? So their names were not published so that they could... No, their names were published, weren't they?
The Home Secretary at the time had decided that essentially, because there was so much media attention, the boys who I think were 10 and 11 or around about that age, they would be tried as adults.
Oh, okay.
So the names were released.
It was their new identities. Their new identities weren't released. Yeah, I can understand that. I don't think in the case of the Christchurch shooter, maybe they'll be rehabilitated. It is possible for terrorists to be rehabilitated, but he certainly wouldn't be necessarily freed for the amount of people that he's killed and hurt. And we do know his name as well. We just choose not to speak it. The same with the killer of Joe Cox. We know his, well, I don't remember it off my head, actually. But
no.
We do know his name. And, you know, that was public knowledge. We have the choice to not use it. So it's not giving them, they're not getting away with anything. They're, you know, their reputation isn't being unsullied or anything like that. They're not getting special treatment.
Yeah, they are still going to face criminal justice.
It's just not giving them the notoriety that comes with that.
Yeah.
And I just think instead of a documentary about Ted Bundy, what if Netflix had produced something about his victims instead?
That's kind of what happened with the recent documentary on, was it Lorraine Bobbitt? Because, like, for instance, the story had all been about him. And so they went back and it was like her point of view and why it happened and what her life has been like. And it was a much more interesting story as a result.
Yeah, just last week, there was the BBC did a 3-part documentary on the Yorkshire Ripper and the murders from the 70s that were, and that was very much focused on the victims. And it was done in a way that it was actually talking more about the kind of sexism, the classism that was just pervasive in society at the time. And I think they only actually showed Peter Sutcliffe's face once. He was almost not even the centre of the story. It was about the victims themselves.
I've been reading a book that was recently published called The Five. It's The Five, The Untold Lives of the Women Killed by Jack the Ripper. And that the approach to that book is it's all about the women. I mean, very briefly in each kind of chapter or each section about the women, it mentions obviously that they were murdered by the Ripper, but that's the only mention that the Ripper gets. And every single section is about their lives, the things that they went through. And I thought it was quite a refreshing approach because, for example, I learned quite a lot about the whole case that I didn't know before. Like, I didn't know that not all of the victims were not sex workers, that none of the women came from Whitechapel, and that most of them were in their 40s.
When I'm doing my research for 1888, I obviously you started reading about everything that you can find out about the women themselves. And there was, I had no idea that some of them were married, some of them had children. Yeah. You always just thought of them as being these sort of like lone streetwalkers in the...
And they didn't necessarily know each other.
Yeah, they had lives and experiences that weren't just about sex work and they weren't just about being murder victims. They did have lives.
What's really interesting about The Five, I haven't finished reading it yet. It's actually quite a tough read. But what I thought was quite interesting is the way that it shines a light on the society of the time. Because it seems as though the middle class society judged the women to be like the worst of society and they were a victim of their own circumstances. But actually it was society that had failed each and every one of those women instead. So it definitely seems as though there have been some shifts with more media being produced that has a focus on, you know, the victims. Mm.
Which I tend to think are more interesting stories generally anyway, that usually when you have got, especially serial killers, what are they actually going to let you know? There was that the Ted Bundy documentary series that I mentioned earlier. I turned it off after a few minutes because it was just like, he is not going to let us know anything because he is a psychopath and he is playing us, playing the audience in these interview tapes to portray him in whatever way he wants to be. You know, at one point he sort of changed his motive story and made it all to do with like his pornography addiction because that was the big thing in the media at the time, was that the damaging effect that pornography was having on people. So he attempted to manipulate whoever was listening, and I don't think that that's an interesting story to listen to.
I much prefer things that kind of are more journalistic in a way. So for example, I'm currently listening to the Atlanta Monster podcast. It tells the story of the Atlanta child murders, and the host basically examines this kind of series of disappearances and murders of over 25 African-American children about 40 or so years ago. And also I really enjoyed season one of In the Dark, which looked at the case of the disappearance of Jacob Wetterling.
Oh yes,
but also kind of examined the way it had been investigated by the police at the time. And I think those sorts of shows have a lot more to offer people than a documentary on Ted Bundy, or that, what was that one on Netflix, True Genius?
There are so many of them now. I struggle to keep them all separate in my head.
There are some true crime things which kind of sensationalize and shock, and that's their aim. And then there are those which take the listener or the viewer sort of on a journey through the case and the people involved. And I think sometimes you can come away feeling quite shocked or disgusted. And I think actually you should be shocked and disgusted because something terrible has happened. So as we reach the end of this episode, I guess the obvious question is, do you guys have any true crime related things that you would recommend?
I have one, which I mentioned it quite briefly as we were talking about making this podcast. And it is a film called London Road, which came out a few years ago. And it was based on a play, I think it was done by the National Theatre. And it was about the Ipswich murders. And it's a musical, which seems very unlikely. But the songs in it, the lyrics and all spoken words are based on interviews of people who lived in this road, which is at the centre of the murders. And it is something wildly different to anything I've ever seen before. And it is really sensitively handled and it's incredibly moving. And I do recommend it to anybody to see.
There's a book that I would recommend, which is written by Scott Bonn, who's professor of criminology at Drew University. And it's called Why We Love Serial Killers. And it basically looks at the fascination people have with true crime and especially serial killers. I think I also mentioned In the Dark, which I thoroughly recommend, and The Atlanta Monster. And, oh yeah, The Five, which I'm currently reading, which is a book published by Penguin about the victims of Jack the Ripper.
I will definitely be giving that one a read.
I don't have any recommendations. Go watch something nice. Cheer up.
Yes. Just watch something nice.
Go see if, like, there's an old episode of Rainbow on YouTube. Something like that. You know what I mean? Go watch Button Moon. an episode of Bagpuss is good. I'm just saying, if it gets too heavy, there are options.
Yeah. Bagpuss is always there.
I found a copy of the Bagpuss soundtrack on vinyl in a record store, and I'm going down at the weekend to get it. It's every single song from the series on vinyl, and I have to get that for my soul.
That is absolutely adorable.
So yeah, get something nice. Don't worry about Jack the Ripper.
No, he's almost definitely not alive anymore.
Yeah, odds are good that you're going to be safe.
And the chances are that his ghost can't hurt you either.
Absolutely.
Not unless you've seen a horror film. Well, that's the basic plot.
When you look at the actual Jack the Ripper medium, there are so many contemporary Jack the Ripper. And it's always either the ghost of Jack the Ripper has possessed somebody, or it's a copycat.
Or relative.
Yeah.
If you're listening, Jack the Ripper's ghost, come fight us.
Yeah, tell us who you were first.
No, I don't even care about that. No. just come fight us.
I want to know who's beat me up, Hayley, frankly.
Jack the Ripper's ghost.
Yeah, but what do I call him? Mr. Ripper?
Twat.
I need to have it first.
Just call him a twat. Bring it on, you ghostly twat.
I'm not getting involved in this fight. You've picked it.
This one's for Annie Chapman.